This is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Of course, I'm reminding you that we Zoom on a Wednesday morning, so if something should happen Wednesday night, we'll be discussing it on Friday. Now you've come to expect a new beginning on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We begin with what I call political verse, what Calvin Trillin is to the nation, ST is to The Attitude. Okay, Dave, hit it.
Istanbul was Constantinople, now it's Istanbul, now Constantinople. Been a long time gone, Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
We can see that he's just a sore loser, this teetotaler who isn't a boozer. But something's clouding his mind, cause he's pretty far behind. Now he's putting A.G. Barr in a cruiser.
People just like it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
All right, everyone. Now that you've had your political verse for the day, this is going to be an hour dedicated to the environment. And I'm actually quite excited, because I'm actually talking positively about the environment, because with Joe Biden assenting to the leadership role as president of the United States, we can begin to imagine addressing things like climate change, looking at the Paris Accord, all the things that we have sort of watched getting dismantled over the 4 years as Donald Trump deregulated, genuflected to sort of the dirty industries, basically said, screw you to anything that might actually clean up our environment and protect us and move us forward on climate change. There are so many things on Joe Biden's plate, which is why when I went to Vox, I saw a fabulous article entitled, How Joe Biden Plans to Use Executive Powers to Fight Climate Change. 10 Ways Biden Plans to Fight Climate Change With or Without Congress. That's the operative word, with or without Congress. Umer Irfan is joining us. He covers climate change, energy, and the environment. He's also a contributor to Science Friday, which I'm so jealous of. So let me welcome Umer to the program. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Arnie.
There is so much that Biden needs to do. And I guess the great news is that the minute he steps into office, he can at least undo a lot of the executive orders that Donald Trump did. I mean, maybe the good news, Umer, is that they didn't do much in Congress. So he doesn't have a lot of, you know, congressional action that he has to undo. There's congressional action he may want to move forward on, but he doesn't have to do a lot of sort of damage from that perspective, because so much was done by the treaties that we stepped away from, as well as the executive orders and the personnel in places like the EPA, in energy. As everyone knows, personnel is policy. With that as my opening salvo, let's talk about your article and about what you know from talking to people, what Biden can do, and what he has already sort of told folks he plans to do. You know, those are not necessarily always the same thing. One is very public, and the other one is a little more behind the scenes. But from a public perspective, what are we hearing from the potentially new Biden administration?
Well, the Biden administration has made climate change one of their top priorities, not just in the environment, but generally. He brought it up in his acceptance speech, and he brought it up again when he declared victory just the other day. And so this is clearly something that is going to be a through line through his administration. From the campaign, that throughout that, he's been, you know, hammering home some of the things that he intends to do. Now, certainly among the Democratic candidates, he wasn't the most extreme. You know, Bernie Sanders had like a $16 trillion plan to deal with climate change. But what Joe Biden has proposed is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, this would certainly be the most significant environmental intervention in U.S. history if he were to pull everything off that he wants to do. Now, he wants a comprehensive suite of legislation and policy throughout government, but there's only so much you can do without Congress, as you noted. And so he has that in mind. And a critical bit of context here is his last turn in government under President Obama. President Obama also implemented a number of different climate change policies, but he also did them from the White House because the Senate wasn't on his side. The Republicans controlled it. And so what we realized, though, is that anything you can do from the White House can be undone by the White House. And that's what the lesson of the Trump administration. President Trump has systematically undone everything that Obama did, particularly on climate change, things like the Clean Power Plan, things like appliance efficiency standards, and things like fuel economy for cars and trucks. So yes, Joe Biden can easily start to undo that as well. But the question is, like, are we just going to have this back and forth from here on out, or is there a way to actually nail these things down?
So let me just have you here for a second, Umer, because the good news is that what Joe Biden may have in his pocket, and we actually began to see this under Donald Trump, is that a lot of corporate America has already bought in. They're not going to roll back. They're already moving, looking at electric cars. I mean, let's be honest. If you're GM, your biggest sales are not even in the United States. They're probably in China. So when you look at the world as your oyster and you're making cars or you're making trucks or you're making refrigerators, whatever it is you're making, it isn't just us that's your market. And the market around the world is really galloping towards something that's more energy efficient, something that uses electricity as opposed to gas or oil. What he has is a better ability to partner with corporate America, because no matter what happens 4 years from now, if there's another president, corporate America has already bought in. And all he's doing, I think, is going to sort of not only return us to what Obama was doing, but also kind of give them a sense of, phew, I don't have to fight them as well, and then continue to move forward. Am I correct on that?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the critical bits of context here that's really important. What's different for Biden than it was for Obama is that now he has a grassroots coalition. One of the things that President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Treaty did was that it galvanized a group of states, cities, and private companies that all said that they're still actually committed to doing things on climate change, and it actually forced them to commit to doing more. And so now you have states like California, you know, the largest state in the country, and New York, and you know, have governors of major cities all across the country. And then you have major companies like automakers. Just this past year, companies like Ford, for instance, reached a deal with California to actually implement tougher fuel economy standards than what the Trump administration was doing. And that's because they realized that, you know, the future is going to be more energy efficient, that they have to start preparing for that now, and they would rather have those rules on their terms. So even while Congress may not cooperate with Joe Biden, a lot of states, a lot of cities, and also a grassroots activist movement, there's a lot of energy, particularly among young people, that are motivated around climate change. And this is something that we didn't see, you know, even 5 years ago. This is something that's drastically different now. So even without legislation, we could still see a significant amount of action.
I did environmental policy when I was in the legislature many, many years ago. I'm an old woman now. But anyway, but years ago, we were always grateful for California. Because ultimately, if we couldn't get it through the federal government, what we knew is that if California changed its standards, because it was such a huge consumer, because it's really almost the size of a country, in fact, it is almost the size of a country, that if it sort of set a high standard, corporate America would have to sort of comply with that because it was just too important. And then as a result, we would sort of get the trickle down of quality environmental standards that were set by California. What we see now is now we have a Biden administration that will sort of echo what you've seen in places like California, Oregon, Washington, maybe even New York. And now we can set more of a national standard through executive orders. And you've got corporate America that I think is bought in. We're moving in the right direction. I guess one of my questions for you, though, is, are we moving fast enough? Even with all these positive things, I noticed that you had a second article. We're not going to probably get to it, but it was just talking about the number of hurricanes, which are just like mind-blowing. They've gone through the alphabet. They're going through the Greek alphabet. I don't know. Is there a Hebrew alphabet? We're going to be going through everybody's alphabet. When you see that, as you look at the things that we're going to talk about, the 10 things, does that really move the needle, I guess is my question.
I'd say it's a good first step. I mean, you're right that, you know, time is running out. A lot of the benchmarks that we're talking about are aimed at 2050. 2050 is 30 years from now. A child born today will be starting their family around that time. For people like me, like this is the world that we will be retiring into. You know, this is a lot. Many of the people alive today will see 2050. So we are laying the groundwork for that right now. So it's not something that's far off. You need to start taking action now. And Biden has understood that. You know, he's talked about an aggressive shift towards clean energy away from fossil fuels, though he hasn't committed to any kind of mandate. Like, you know, you may have followed that debate around fracking and how Joe Biden said that he would not ban hydraulic fracturing. On the other hand, though, fossil fuels are already losing on the market on their own. You know, coal is going down the tubes completely just based on market forces. And even oil companies like BP, even in Chevron and ExxonMobil, for instance, like they're seeing their stock prices bounce all over the place. And they're all talking about how they're going to deal with a world where their product may not be allowed to be sold. These are all things that, you know, you have to contend with now because the goalpost may be far away, but you have to get on that path now. And certainly, you know, Biden is talking about doing that with some of his executive actions like methane limits on public lands, like methane pollution, things like getting the federal government to use its purchasing power to buy clean energy, to buy clean vehicles.
Let me just stop you there. Yeah. I love this because this is actually parallel to something I've had a conversation with the guy from Connecticut. And the idea is that we purchase a hell of a lot of stuff, billions of dollars. And if all of a sudden you started purchasing electric cars, electric trucks, just by doing that alone, not only will you be beefing up what is happening for these companies that are moving into this, But by buying more of them, you actually help bring the price down because you're actually investing in this. As a sidebar, a friend of mine was talking to me about the fact that what he's hoping is if Joe Biden has the public option, that we move every federal worker into the public option. They then become, so you move them out of whatever the plan is they are and move them into the public option. I think in a lot of ways, that huge clout of really taking those dollars and investing them in what you believe will ultimately be the best public policy will actually become a form of public policy without actually having Congress passing anything.
Right. The federal government in the U.S. is massive, right? And just about anything it does will move the market. So once it decides to buy electric vehicles, like just for its motor pools, that's something that can move the industry. I mean, like one of the big things that was in, for instance, the Democrats' infrastructure bill that they passed the House earlier this year was electric mail trucks, for instance. They want the U.S. Postal Service to be using these trucks because this is the perfect use case for an electric car because, you know, these are trucks that run a circle route. They go back to the same place every night and they have to just be charged in their fleet vehicles. If you can do that, then basically you bring the cost of batteries down, you bring the cost of the supply chains down, and you bring a lot of manufacturing into the U.S. because a lot of this has to be done domestically. And so this is where the U.S. could easily have an edge. On the other hand, one thing to consider is that other countries are also betting big on electric, particularly China. And if they get the dominant supply chain and if they can undercut us in terms of cost, then we cede this market to them. And so for the federal government, like rather than, you know, mandating that we buy American or putting tariffs, one way it can accelerate the U.S. market is by buying electric American cars, buying energy efficient American appliances. There they can get the economy of scale and then also beat them on cost without having to put tariffs or do any of these other kinds of economic interventions.
When I saw that, I started screaming because I was like, of course, what a great idea. Use the muscle of those dollars into ultimately what you want to accomplish, which is both American jobs as well as climate change. It works on so many levels, which is why I was totally ecstatic. Again, we're talking with Umar Irfan. He is with Vox, how Joe Biden plans to use executive powers to fight climate change. Okay, so now we know we're using purchasing power. Now we know he's going to like use some executive orders and roll back Donald Trump. He's also going to be rejoining the Paris Accord. What other accords is he going to rejoin? So I just want to know, and what does that actually mean?
Sure. Let's start with the Paris Accord. So this was the 2015 global agreement that basically said every country in the world has a role to play in fighting climate change, but every country in the world gets to decide what they actually do. And those seem a little bit contradictory, but that was kind of a necessary concession to get everybody on board. You know, with a treaty like this, you know, you can't force anybody at gunpoint to agree to this. You have to, anybody can take their ball and go home. And so certainly that was one of the things here. But by rejoining, the U.S. is the second largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world right now. It's also the largest historical emitter. So the U.S. has both like a moral obligation, but also a huge leadership role here. And so a lot of countries are very excited to see the U.S. rejoin the accord. While they are other members of the treaty are going to, you know, not a treaty, but an agreement, actually, are going to be happy to see the U.S. back. The U.S. does have to make up for some lost ground. So this year, for instance, countries were supposed to come up with a new set of targets aimed at 2030. The first set of targets were aimed at 2025. The U.S. is already behind on those. Now the U.S. has to come up with another round of targets. The other thing is that the U.S. is also behind on its contributions to the Green Climate Fund, which is this international fund that helps developing countries adapt and mitigate climate change. Those are some of the good faith things that the U.S. would need to do to get back into good standing. But there are other international treaties, as you noted. There's things like the Montreal Protocol on these super pollutants. These are these hydrofluorocarbons, things like refrigerants. These are very potent greenhouse gases, and they're thousands of times more powerful than CO2 at trapping heat in the atmosphere. So if you can just reduce them just by a minuscule amount, you have orders of magnitude more effect in terms of mitigating climate change. And so that's a separate treaty that the U.S. is actually involved in. There's a section of it called the Kigali Amendment that the Trump administration sort of put on pause. Joe Biden can ratify that and bring us back into that. And there are other like climate adjacent things like forests, like helping us, you know, develop a mechanism to preserve tropical rainforests around the world. Also encouraging other countries to help, you know, preserve their ecosystems and things like that. So there's a number of different international frameworks that we can get into. And that under the executive branch, you know, Congress can't really interfere with that. That is his prerogative as president to do. And so that's something he can make.
Another of his prerogatives, although there may be some confirmation issues, is that personnel is policy. There's a lot of coal lobbyists I'd like to see like walked out the door now with the Trump administration. What are we hearing about what he would like to appoint to EPA, to energy, to the different government? And my understanding is a lot of these will require some kind of confirmation. So how does he thread the needle giving something that Mitch McConnell will somehow approve and at the same time be able to move the ball forward.
Right. I mean, Mitch McConnell has pretty much said that he wants to stymie Joe Biden from filling his cabinet, and that is going to be a big hurdle. But if you look at some of the advanced teams, like Joe Biden put out a list of some of the folks that he's having to lay the groundwork for all these federal agencies. And you see, one, these are a lot of folks from business and, you know, the banking sector and things like that, but also a lot of people that are involved in activist circles, things like social justice causes. And so that seems to be a big component, particularly when it comes to the environment. His EPA team includes, you know, writers as well as, you know, former agency officials and people in the business sector as well. So a big thing is going to be looking at the non-congressionally confirmed positions. There's going to be appointments that don't necessarily have to be confirmed by Congress. Joe Biden can make those choices. And then there's going to be a lot of acting roles that are going to be held out for a while he tries to confirm them. There's a number of agency officials that are career officials that will probably continue to carry on the mission, and that's what Joe Biden will have to work with. On the other hand, though, the Trump administration recently has been trying to do something they call burrowing, where they basically take their political appointments and put them in career positions so that they stay behind when the transition takes place. And so we saw that recently where, you know, NOAA's acting chief scientist was asked to step down to make way for a Trump appointee. And so the chief scientist, NOAA doesn't have a fully confirmed head. Trump never bothered to nominate anybody. But when the acting chief scientist tried to enforce their scientific integrity policy to tell a new political appointee that, you know, you can't have politics interfering with our science, he was immediately demoted, and another scientist from the Cato Institute was brought in. And we're seeing this across the other, you know, at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Like, there was a...
And how do you cut the cancer out? I guess my question is, now that they're there, how long do they stay? What is the personnel policy? How do you remove them, given what they're being done is to really sort of, they're like minefields. They're intentional minefields. This isn't about personnel. It is all about politics. It isn't about, you know, enforcing regulation. It's about basically eroding regulation. So what does he do, given that they're put into this new sort of category? How are they removed?
It's going to be difficult. I mean, that is the difficult thing with career employees, because, you know, they're not political and they don't serve at the behest of the president on paper. And so that's going to have to go through the actual administrative process within agencies. And that makes this a little bit more difficult to do. On the other hand, though, I mean, it is expected that just about every political appointee will resign at the turn of the administration, but we don't know if they'll do that, given that the president, current president himself, refuses to concede the election. It's really hard to say what will happen. I mean, I don't really have a good answer for you for how they're going to solve this problem.
I have a dream. Jimmy Carter actually slept in my house. We have a plaque over the bedroom door, because remember, I live in New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, you know, this is a place where all presidential candidates sort of begin to strut their stuff. And Jimmy Carter slept in one of the bedrooms, like right across from this hallway. I remember Jimmy Carter putting solar panels on the roof of the White House. So here's my question. What are we going to see? Because you mentioned in your article about ensuring that all U.S. government installations, buildings, and facilities are more efficient and climate ready, harnessing the purchasing power and supply chains to drive innovation. So let's talk about the White House. We know what Melania did to one of the gardens, but I want to know if they're even talking about sort of displaying role modeling, something using the White House as the vehicle, other than chain link fences and brick fences and concrete. Have they talked about doing something that relates to that?
I haven't heard anything to that effect, but I think you're right. Like, this would be an excellent model. This would be a great case study if they could turn the White House into a net zero energy building or something that is like, you know, a green space that also generates and like serves as a rain garden that helps produce its own water. If it becomes more self-sustaining, this would be an excellent model, just sort of to show just American homeowners, businesses, and just anybody who owns a building what is possible. This would be a great showcase of that. Certainly, I mean, I think energy efficiency across all federal buildings is going to be a part of that. And the White House is a federal building, so it will be beholden to that order. And so I would be very keen to see what they end up doing.
That's been the problem with Donald Trump, is that what kind of a role model is he? And now I'm looking at Joe Biden, and it's not just he's nice. It's not just he's cordial. It's not that he just doesn't lie. But a lot of his behaviors and where he puts his effort will also role model for a lot of people. And if he could show, this was the electric bill for the White House. We then made it energy efficient. This is the electric bill. Imagine what you could pocket if we could do this for you. I mean, it just sort of kind of reinforces exactly what it is that he wants to accomplish. I'm going to have another guest on to talk about the environment as well. And I do have to tell you, I am dying to do this. But I was walking down the street a couple of weeks ago, and there was a huge array of solar panels on this house, okay? But there were Trump signs on their lawn. And I was dying to walk in and say, so can we talk about climate change? Or is this all about cash? It does tell you that whether you're a conservative or a liberal, climate change, there is a benefit here. And it's in your wallet. If you're creating energy efficiency, no matter what it is, it's going to have an impact on what you are writing in the way of an electric bill or a gas bill. And I think that's important. As we're going through the rest of the 10, I just want to also remind everyone, one of the things you said at the very opening of our conversation was that, you know, you look at Bernie Sanders and AOC and the Green New Deal, and it was, you know, I don't know how many point plan and how many trillions of dollars were being spent. And then you look at Joe Biden, it was much more modest than that. Wasn't that a gift from Bernie Sanders and AOC? Because it changed the spectrum of the conversation. Everyone I know is very angry at some of the very progressive agendas that we've seen happen. But what they've done is, I wish people could see my hands. I remember running for governor. And when I ran for governor, I changed the spectrum. It wasn't from the center to the right. It was from the left to the right. And therefore, when you found center, you found a more true center. So in an interesting way, what Bernie and AOC have done with their Green New Deal has given Joe Biden a really fabulous space upon which to actually move the country in a direction that one, we have to go, but that will accomplish many things. The jobs, the climate change, the saving money, all those things will really make a difference. Am I right?
Absolutely. Here in DC, we call that the Overton window, which is basically the window of things that are considered acceptable. And certainly by having a radical flank, by having somebody putting a $16 trillion plan on the table, you know, $1.7 trillion as Joe Biden calls for here, seems like a much more reasonable and sensible thing. And potentially it could be. I mean, on the other hand, you could argue that, you know, Bernie's plan is actually the more sensible one because it's the one that's actually grappling with the full extent of the problem. And that's a good discussion to have. I mean, you're framing it around actually acknowledging that this is a problem that needs a solution rather than whether this problem exists or not, which is what we've been trying to do over the past 20, 30 years. That's certainly a good sign that we're seeing that discussion here. And I just kind of want to see, in addition to Biden, like, will the legislators in Congress, the Democrats, continue to set the agenda, continue to try to outflank him and pull him in their direction? Or will they start conceding and trying to move to the center to try to bring the Republicans on board to pass something?
I always say that Joe Biden becomes the moment. He leads from behind. That's how Joe Biden leads. And if you've looked at his sort of history, he's never been an edge walker. He's been a great follower. I mean, I even look at the crime bill, and I'm even looking at the welfare reform bill, and I'm looking at some of the bills that he like agreed to or sort of showcase when he was a senator, and he was helping Bill Clinton. All right, so that's what he was doing. And he's always sort of seen his role that way. I think given the nature of the pandemic, the economy, climate change, as well as a new muscle that we're now beginning to see with the progressives, I think that the moment will transform him. And he will, I think, to some extent, respond to the moment. I want to go to your other articles about hurricanes. And I want to connect it, actually, to your article about climate change and executive power. I want to have a come to Jesus moment with a lot of the oil and gas industry. Because let's go to Houston, because one of my biggest radio audiences is Houston, Texas. All right. We know that it's, you know, oil and gas is really important to Houston. But what we know is who's being buffered by hurricanes are places like Houston. What does that mean for oil and gas? It really has impact on refineries. It has impact on drilling. So in a bizarre way, they are also being pummeled, not just by what's happening with the market. They're also being pummeled by climate change, which is actually making it more difficult for them to do the refining and the jobs they want. I'm just trying to figure out whether this climate scenario has also helped to change the oil and gas industry, because now it's getting harder and harder to do what you've done historically just because of the changing climate.
You may have noticed, you know, anytime there is a big storm that helps towards the Gulf Coast, gas prices across the U.S. will shoot up. Mm-hmm. In fact, recently, I think a couple of years ago, oil drillers in the Gulf were asking for federal help to insulate their facilities from climate change from the federal government. So they fully acknowledge this, right? I mean, you've also seen oil companies like Shell betting on drilling in the Arctic because they're counting on it being ice-free in the next few years. So these companies, I mean, we've known historically that like their internal science has shown that climate change is real and that they've been behaving as though climate change is real and betting on it while publicly casting doubt and, you know, trying to muddle the conversation. And so that's kind of the thing that we have to deal with. It's a lot like the tobacco companies, you know, where we knew that, for instance, that the risks, they knew that their product was addictive and they knew they were addicting people very young. But publicly, they were saying that there's no connection between the two. Now the issue is that it's going to start to affect their business model. They know that, for instance, that the European Union has said basically that they want to go to zero by 2050, that the internal combustion engine is going to be banned in cities like Amsterdam. They're talking about a complete ban on these gasoline-powered cars. How do you operate in that world when your sole business is making these fossil fuels? And they're trying to diversify. They're certainly trying to get ahead of it. The question is whether they're going to facilitate the process legislatively, or are they going to try to buy as much time for themselves as they can?
One of the reasons why I fight pipelines, you know, I know gas is better than oil, and it's the bridge to whatever. The problem is, if you build it, they will come. And so the problem is that a lot of these companies have spent billions, if not trillions of dollars in these investments in order to create their refineries, their oil drilling, the fracking, in order for them to sort of want to gallop into the future. They're doing this cost-benefit analysis. How long can we drag you back in order to pay back, you know, what we've already invested in? So I guess I have a question for you, Omar. Can I buy them out? I'm like, okay, how much did you spend on that pipeline? I'll buy it from you. Okay, dismantle it. I'll buy it from you. Let's get it. Because I get it. What I need to know is, we write checks for lots of crap. Let's write checks for this. Because if I can write them a check to have them dismantle this, then they can start looking at, you know, algae as a form of energy, or switchgrass, or whatever it is. I'll applaud them for that. But I also understand that they really have looked at this investment and they're trying to figure out, I can't piss it away. So my theory is, then I'll buy it from you.
Yeah. I mean, to your earlier point about, you know, setting a radical flank and having the agenda window move. I mean, that this is something that's now in the discussion, is like, can we buy out the fossil fuel industry?
Yes.
There's a term in the industry they call stranded assets. Basically, yes. The idea that like they will own an oil field, but will never be able to exploit it for whatever reason. And they're really terrified of this because they have this on their balance sheet. This is what they use to leverage, to get loans, to build infrastructure. And now they're going to have to go to the bank and say like, oh, that thing that we had that was valuable, we can't use it anymore. And so for them, that's kind of the big thing, is the financial aspect of it. They're not necessarily religiously committed to fossil fuels, but they did place a big bet on it. And if it doesn't pay off, they'll be holding the bag. So that's something, so one thing that you can do. Like, you know, we've seen in other countries, for instance, like in Germany, when they phased out their coal, their hard coal mining industry, the government helped pay out retirement benefits for all the coal miners that were involved in the industry. We could, that helped them transition. That basically say like, look, the business may be gone, but we'll look after the people. We commit to looking after the people to make sure no one's left in the cold. That's something that could be potentially, you know, a viable technique. It just matters of building the political will to do that.
When I was running back in the early 90s, we were watching, you know, one paper mill after another paper mill after another paper mill being shut down. My environmental friends were like, oh, this is incredible. You know, this is wonderful. I'm like, no, it sucks. What are those people going to do for a living? How do they survive? And so what's interesting is if we can somehow get the environmental community to be really supportive of these buyouts, it is great for the companies, technically on paper, but more importantly, it's great for the employees, because that's the fear. That's the fear in the coal industry, which is why Donald Trump does so well in West Virginia. That was the fear in the North Country, when everybody just basically said, oh, no problem, you can lose those plants, we don't care. Well, there's still, it's like how many decades later, and there's still no economy up there. There's nothing. The biggest economy in my North Country, you know what it is? It's prisons. It's prisons and poverty agencies. That is not a life. I'm just hoping that we can also teach the environmental community to understand why this check with a comma in it may actually be the best thing you can do, because it will actually help the workers, get the companies from stopping really moving forward on environmental legislation, and I think address climate change. This has been a fabulous interview. Thank you so much. Again, I'm jealous that you get to work on Science Friday. How Joe Biden plans to use executive powers to fight climate change. 10 ways Biden plans to fight climate change with or without Congress. Umer Irfan, thank you so much for writing for Vox, and I hope you join us again.
Thank you for having me, Arnie.
It was a pleasure. All right, everyone. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. During the coronavirus pandemic, many hospitals have struggled with dangerous shortages of personal protective equipment. But Jody Sherman of the Yale Schools of Medicine and Public Health says a pandemic is not the only reason medical supplies can run short. Extreme weather can disrupt manufacturing or transportation.
And so essentially it's an interruption of the supply chain.
For example, Hurricane Maria affected production at facilities that make medical equipment in Puerto Rico, causing nationwide shortages of critical supplies like IV bags. So Sherman says it's important to make hospitals more resilient to these interruptions. For example, by relying less on single-use medical supplies.
There's been this enormous trend toward everything being disposable, from simple devices like a blood pressure cuff or even a patient's pillow to very complex surgical devices.
Sometimes single-use products are necessary for safety, but Sherman says many products can be designed for sterilization and reuse. She says that could reduce hospitals' reliance on supply chains that are vulnerable to the effects of climate change or a global pandemic. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, another reminder, we are Zooming on Wednesday morning. This is my climate change, environmental day. I'm actually so excited because with Joe Biden as our next president, I can begin to actually talk about these things and imagine accomplishing these things. And the other thing that's exciting about Joe Biden is sort of what brought him to the table. And it was the African-American community. And in particular, it was women, all right? So the combination of African-Americans and Blacks and minorities and women really kind of almost is a perfect underpinning for our next guest because of the book she has written. And the title of the book is Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. And in a interesting way, Jenny Stevens, I am looking at the Biden administration. I feel like they actually read your book because I think in a lot of ways, what they will be able to do and be empowered by is all the voters, you know, the 77 million or however many, but it really sort of does represent, I think, the muscle of Black Americans and women to really sort of say, we're going to deliver a win for you. But there has to be something that also listens to us. I'm looking at your background, Jenny Stevens, and almost what you do for a living is why you wrote this book. Because let me just read this to my audience. You are the director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University. You are also the Dean's Professor of Sustainability, Science, and Policy. You also are the director of Strategic Research Collaboration at Northeastern's Global Resilience Institute. And I'm exhausted already. A member of the executive committee of Northeastern's Women, Gender, Sexuality Studies program. I am just describing your book because you have literally become an octopus and you have your arm on all these different things and you are the center of that octopus. Because what you realize is I have to understand engineering. I have to understand women and gender. I have to understand urban affairs and public policy. And by looking at all those things, you've embraced the gestalt. You've looked at the whole. And from that whole, it just becomes obvious why you would write the book, Diversifying Power. So thank you for joining us. And let's talk a little bit about this book that really sort of reflects your life.
Yeah, well, thank you, Arnie. And yes, this book has, as you mentioned, it brings together a lot of different themes of that and experiences. I've been working on climate energy issues for my whole career, so 20, 25 years now. Most of the framing of climate and energy is very technocratic, based on science and technology, which is very important. Yet what we've missed in a lot of the discussions and the public discourse and the public policy associated with climate is the social justice implications. So we've invested, I think, too much in technological innovation and the science of climate change, and the discourse often stays there, which is a kind of limiting perspective. And we have not yet connected the climate crisis with economic justice and racial justice and social justice and the opportunities for reinvesting in our communities and our families and our infrastructure in ways that are good for everybody, right? So much of our policy has really been good for some, potentially, but not really getting at the core issues that we need to confront and transform society so that we are responding effectively to the climate crisis.
I give a lot of speeches. I've given a lot of graduation speeches. One word I use a lot, and I kind of, you didn't use the word, but I thought of it, is that what I think is important about the conversation about climate change is the concept of generational ethics, all right? That we are stewards of this planet. And the operative word is we, not the business community, not the energy community. The idea is we are stewards. So if we are going to move forward addressing the energy issues and the climate change issues, not only do we have to look at the next generation, but we have to look at the buy-in by all of us. And the buy-in shouldn't just be who sacrifices, but the idea is there are benefits from addressing climate change. And if we don't recognize the benefits and then share those benefits, then we have actually undermined our ability to sort of get there quicker, number one, without resentment, number two, and everyone sees why it's a win for them as well.
Absolutely. We have opportunities. The climate crisis actually presents us with an opportunity to reevaluate and restructure and figure out why have we had this concentration of wealth and power. Because that's actually what we've had in the United States over the past four decades. There has been a real intentional concentration of wealth and power with the 1% and what some of us are now calling the polluter elite, which are individuals and organizations that are profiting from sustaining fossil fuel reliance, right? And they've been strategically investing for decades to resist the transformation toward a more renewable-based future. And they've been doing that through a misinformation campaign to deny climate science and confuse us about climate. They've also been undermining public trust in government, dismantling regulations designed to protect our public health, and minimizing worker protections and worker rights. And all of those things are connected. We're at a tipping point, right, where we are right now. We're in such a dire situation with so much hardship and suffering, with the pandemic revealing the economic injustices, the racial injustices that we have become too complacent toward. And you're exactly right in terms of the collective. We need to, and thinking ahead about generational justice. And I have two daughters myself who are 19 and 21, and the youth here are so important. And they were actually critical also to the election that we just had, right? Because young people, the Sunrise Movement and others, and the Black Lives Matter movement, people are coming together and saying, this is not the world we want to live in, and we can't anymore, right? We actually need transformative change. You know, young people aren't just worried about the climate crisis, but people are worried about the economic future, right? And what are the opportunities, and can we think about a society that is prosperous for everybody, not just for some?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've been screaming at the TV whenever I watched Joe Biden when he was talking, and I kept saying, here's the simple answer about the pandemic. The pandemic is the economy. The pandemic is the economy. Don't ever say pandemic without saying it is the economy. for a while there, it said that, you know, Donald Trump was doing better on the economy than Joe Biden. I'm like, no, he ain't. Because if the pandemic is the economy and he's sucking wind on the pandemic and people are dying and people are afraid to go to school and people, then he is hurting the economy. In a way, climate change is the economy. It is exactly the parallel track to the pandemic is climate change. And as I'm listening to you, anyone who's listened to this show, and I've been doing this for way too long, I have been beating the drum about the concept of the democratization of energy. I use that expression all the frickin' time. And one of the reasons why Mobil Oil and BP and, you know, Northeast Utilities does not like Arne Arnesen is because they have had control of energy. And what is possible now because of geothermal, because of solar, because of energy efficiency, because of efficient appliances, is that I don't frickin' need them. I don't even need their grid, maybe. I don't need them to, like, you know, put the gas meter on my house. Is that what is powerful about climate change is that in a lot of ways, it's very libertarian. And we don't use that word. And I'm going to tell you right now, Jenny, start using libertarian when you talk about energy and the democratization of energy. Because I come from a very libertarian state. I married a libertarian, believe it or not, my second husband, which was kind of a shock to the world. One of the things he valued in me was that I actually saw the libertarian potential in things like fighting climate change, which means it's a better sell for everyone because everyone then gets to own theirs. And at the same time, it works for the collective good.
This idea of energy democracy is something I write about. And it is so powerful and it is transformative. And that's the thing. It's not just about a technological substitute switching out and putting solar panels in, right? It's so much more than that, as you've been talking about and as you've been elevating in your discussions too, because it's literally and figuratively distributing power. Because when we think about the self-sufficiency and the libertarian possibilities, right, of regionally local, managed, controlled, owned, benefits local of a renewable-based future, we see it's not just wind and solar. Coastal communities, you could have wave and tidal energy and offshore wind. Inland, you can have wind and solar at multiple different scales. But then, as you mentioned, you can also have geothermal energy, which is an amazing source that we have not invested in and taken advantage of. And the thing with renewable energy is it's plentiful, abundant, and actually free. Once you've invested in the technology to harness that power, it keeps coming. It's so reliable.
But that explains why the big companies are so afraid, because they controlled it before. They had the nuclear power plant. They had the oil field. They had the coal mine. Therefore, they were the only ones that could produce your energy. The democratization of energy says, no, you got a roof. Okay? That's your energy. You got wind. That's your energy. And because wind is everywhere and the sun is everywhere and geothermal is almost everywhere, what you've got is, I mean, that's what's so exciting about it is that it's so accessible, but that's, you know this, Jenny, that's what makes it such a threat.
And that's why we've seen doubling down on fossil fuel interests, right? Because they are so threatened. And I mean, it's inevitable at some point we will get there. It's the question is, can we accelerate it now? And can we leverage the pandemic situation we're in now, where we are going to have public investments to rebuild, to rebound? And this is an opportunity for like the green recovery, right? It's really important. And this is what gets back to the leadership. It's so important that the right people are involved and at the table when the decisions are made about what investments we are going to be making, what big public investments are we going to be making, and how are those going to get distributed. And that's where when women, people of color, indigenous folks are brought to the table and are given the opportunity in leadership spaces where they've been historically excluded, we are better able to center social justice. We have different life experiences, different perceptions of risk. We can challenge the norms that have been the legacy and the historical structural issues that have perpetuated and exacerbated inequities. And what we need is for those public investments to center social justice, racial justice, and economic justice at the core.
So I've got your book, Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership on Climate and Energy. We're talking with Jenny Stevens. And I turn and I open your book. And of course, it's towards the end. And I see a picture of someone I actually kind of, I don't know her, but she changed my life. And it's a picture of Shirley Chisholm. And it says, bring us together. Vote Chisholm 1972, unbought and unbossed. What you don't know is Shirley Chisholm is what changed my life and how I got political. She spoke in 1984. In 1984, I ran for the legislature. She spoke, she said, get political. My favorite lines is, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. I think my life could be described by a folding chair strapped to my back, because I have walked into rooms where there have been all men, whether it was the military industrial complex, whether it was running for governor, whether it was serving on committees, I was the only female in the room. And I remember at some point in time, I actually spoke to, it was actually in the military industrial complex, and it was a seniors at Lockheed Sanders, okay, which is now BAE Systems. And I walked in, I'm running for governor. And what you have to know, which is so interesting, because again, it's the idea of diversifying power. So I walk in as a candidate for governor, and I have never done this before. I was wearing an all white suit. Okay. I never wear all white. And it was all men at the table, including the person that served coffee. Okay. And I'm looking at the table and they're looking at me, and I'm looking at the table because I'm standing at the top. And this is what I actually said. I almost feel virginal in this room. You have to watch them like cough the coffee up. But in a lot of ways, I don't want to be virginal in a room anymore. I wanted to see, and here's the exciting thing about what you were saying about diversifying power. So of course I lose the election, no surprise. And both the Republicans and the Democrats were afraid of me. But about 7 or 8 months later, the CEO of the company at the time saw me at an event, and he went running up to me and he said, I just want to let you know, Arnie, there are 3 people that look like you sitting at our table now. Meant that there were women, that they were diversifying power at this military industrial complex. And in a way, I had to sort of shame them by saying, look at you and look at me. If I can run for governor, how come I'm not sitting at that table as well? As we're looking at this diversifying of power, it's interesting that women, I think, are actually crucial to this. And the reason that they're crucial is that historically, women have been sort of the embracers of soft power. And by soft power, I mean that their concerns have been education and the environment and healthcare. And men have been good on taxes and business and military and all that stuff. Can you agree with me here, Jenny? What is killing us right now is our failure to address the soft power, our failure on the environment, our failure on healthcare. If we are at risk today, it's not because of a bomb, it's because of a virus. Do you think that the time is ripe, given these 2 threats, climate as well as the pandemic, for people to realize how important it is to diversify power, especially now, if we want to accomplish anything?
Absolutely. I think we are in this time where our collective power to come together and see the connections among these different issues, right, is so critical. I think that we need to lead and act and inspire new leaders, right? And that's why chapter 1 of my book is called Growing the Squad, which the squad, obviously the 4 junior congresswomen who came on the national stage and just changed the discourse about climate and energy by connecting it explicitly to jobs and economic justice and the Green New Deal, and also connecting it to housing and connecting it to the criminal justice system too. And connecting these issues is what we need to do. And it's connecting the soft and the hard power, right? Like, we don't need these bifurcations, right? We need to see the connections, and we really need to focus and acknowledge that when we don't center social justice at the core, we end up with policies and processes that just exacerbate and perpetuate a certain kind of power. And conventional patriarchal power is also very good and has a history of denying the issues, right? Denying climate change, denying that the pandemic is even so dangerous, denying that we have an economic crisis, denying we have a housing crisis, and denying that we have structural racism. And the crises, multiple intersecting crises that evolve from that. We cannot deny anymore, right? And I think, again, being in the moment we're in during this pandemic, we're in a very disruptive time. And that's when there's optimism for bigger transformation, because people are seeing how these issues are connected and that we can't just keep denying, because that isn't in anybody's best interest.
You're not going to believe this, but I was listening to you. I was thinking of the 2008 economic meltdown. There was a lot of vulnerability. Vulnerability on Wall Street, which brought us to our economic knees, but vulnerability on Main Street, vulnerability for homeowners, vulnerability across the board. I'm going to be sexist here in a lot of ways, but the males were really quick to notice the Wall Street vulnerabilities. What they failed to appreciate was everybody else's vulnerability. to a large extent, that brought Donald Trump to the table, I think, in 2016, because they failed to understand. That's another reason why you want diversity in power, because they bring their vulnerability to the table. So it's not just the head of Goldman Sachs at the table explaining his economic vulnerability. It's some guy living in Detroit or some woman living in Tallahassee or whatever, explaining their vulnerability. We're all vulnerable, but the vulnerabilities are different. If you don't understand those vulnerabilities, you're not going to create the policy to address it because it hasn't entered your lexicon. And this is really about sort of expanding the language by expanding the experience.
People have very different risk perceptions of what's risky based on their vulnerabilities, right? There's research that shows that white men, on average, think everything is less risky than women or non-white Americans. That's key to your point. And I think another really important thing to think about during this pandemic time, if you look at the countries in the world that are managing the pandemic
women
most effectively, Jacinda Ardern, Prime Minister of New Zealand, Taiwan, Germany, Denmark, also countries led by women. And it seems like what they bring and the leadership style is taking decisive, evidence-based measures and then communicating to people why that these measures are important, not just for your own health or the health of your family, but the collective of the community and the country, communicating that in a trusted way with compassion that acknowledges people's vulnerabilities, but also gives some hope and some inspiration for why I have to take collective action and keep the virus under control. And that's the same kind of leadership we need on climate and energy.
You mentioned economic justice at the very beginning of our conversation. And I just want to remind everyone how much women earn on the dollar compared to men. I want to remind everyone how women, unfortunately, still today, there's an assumption that we take the time out of our trajectory up the ladder to care for children, to care for parents. I mean, the burden of caring is still, unfortunately, very gender-based, and we live longer. So here we are dealing with all the calamities of life and responsible in part for caring or cleaning up all the calamities of life. So it is not surprising that when you look at women dealing with the pandemic, or frankly, even women dealing with climate change, is that they get it because it's going to be on their plate anyway. And what they're trying to figure out is, if I have to care for someone now that has a pre-existing condition because they got COVID, I'm going to care for them. I am going to be the one to do it. So I don't want them to get it because I don't want to take care of it. I'm going to be selfish here, but it's an interesting selfish because my selfish helps society, helps the person who doesn't have a pre-existing condition. It is the best investment, but unless my ethic and my concern is at the table, what you've seen exactly with Donald Trump, with the return to work and go back to school and don't worry, it doesn't exist, is that they are more prepared to have people be expendable. They're more prepared to not worry about the caring. And I think that's another reason why the message to suburban women, to African-American women was, wait a minute, this is going to impact my life. How do we translate the climate change so that they can see it as clearly as we're talking about the pandemic? The pandemic in some ways is an easy sell when it comes to gender. Climate change is not necessarily as easy.
I think what we need to do is demonstrate that the cost of inaction or continuing things the way they have been is actually higher than the cost of investing now in our communities and in big public investments that are needed. That kind of cost-benefit language is one way that elevates the need for proactive, I mean, at this point, it's not proactive, it's actually urgent investments that are needed, but really accelerating the change. We're past the point of small incremental investments or baby steps, right? We're at a point where we need big transformation. And I think if we can frame it in terms of investing in our communities and our families, for too long across the board, we're seeing underinvestment, right? And people really struggling and suffering. For a country that has so many resources, it doesn't have to be this way, right? And we need to bring back that, as you mentioned, the care work, the value of care and the necessity of it and how essential it is to every aspect and the health of the whole country. We need to value that and make that case.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things we're noticing, for example, from the pandemic is how it's affecting nursing homes And that's just wiping out nursing homes because it's a collective of old people, all of whom are vulnerable, being supported by people who probably don't even have health insurance because they pay them so poorly. Okay. My grandfather back in the 1980s was in a first project called Nursing Home Without Walls. The idea of bringing my grandfather home and caring for him at home. But if you are going to care at home, then guess what you need to do? You need to pay the person who's caring for that person at home. You need to make sure that the bills to heat the house aren't eating away at whatever the little income is. I mean, in a lot of ways, all these things are telling us that if we want people to be able to address the pandemic, then if less of their income is going for their oil bill and their gas bill and their electric bill and all those other things, they will then have more resources both to care for themselves, to care for the person who historically might have had to go to a nursing home, but maybe won't anymore. It's interesting because when you begin to tie all those threads together by supporting all these little pieces, everybody benefits. And yet we've always moved in silos and silos don't work anymore.
Yeah. And I think the crisis in childcare and education right now and the impact it's having on women in the workforce, there are, you know, women are being forced out of the workforce, right? To take care of their and it's disproportionate. So we're actually backtracking by decades, you know, the projections that the pandemic is going to in terms of gender equity in the workforce. So that is another obvious cost, right? And negative that we are going to be seeing. And it's going to become increasingly obvious the impacts of not supporting and ensuring and investing in our education system and our childcare system during this time.
The title of her book, Diversifying Power, Why We Need Anti-Racist Feminist Leadership in Climate and Energy. Jenny Stevens is an educator, social justice advocate, it's pretty obvious, energy expert and sustainability science researcher. She's a professor and director of the School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University, where she holds leadership roles on the Global Reliance Institute. Join me again, Jenny Stevens. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Arnie.
All right. This is, everyone, the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You bet.